Hello, and welcome to another installment of Podcast 360. I'm your moderator, Melinda Stevens, with Gastroenterology Consultant. With us today is Dr. Arnold Wald, who is professor in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He is here to discuss the current management and treatment of diarrhea predominant irritable bowel syndrome. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Wald.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Newer medications are now available for the treatment of IBS and IBSD. How has the management of this condition changed over time?
Well, I think that the issue with managing irritable bowel syndrome is involved in two major symptoms. First is an alteration in bowel habits, constipation, diarrhea, or both. And the second is generally the issue of abdominal pain or discomfort. So the medications that have been developed in the past and more recently have really focused on trying to deal with both of those issues, but they are different according to their effect on bowel function. So in patients who have constipation predominant irritable bowel syndrome, the new medications that have occurred in the past 4 or 5 years have involved the secretory agents, bupivacaine first, linaclotide, and the most recent addition to that is placanotide, which is somewhat similar but not identical to linaclotide, and it's designed to treat constipation and perhaps modulate the pain. With respect to IBSD, there are both new and old drugs. There's rifaximin, which has been used, and which is an antibiotic used for irritable bowel syndrome without constipation. An older drug, which is still around and can be very effective, is alosetron, which is highly restricted. It's in addition to loperamide plus, because loperamide works only on the mu opioid receptors, whereas this new drug works not only on the mu receptor, but also on the delta and kappa opioids. And this has been released for patients, again, with irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea. The other agents out there are really not terribly new, or they're in the pipeline, and they're not yet available for practicing gastroenterologists. I do want to make a mention about the alloxidoline agent, that the one that works on the three opioid receptors. There have been a number of patients who have developed severe abdominal pain and complications, including pancreatitis and perhaps biliary tract abnormalities. And so unlike most medications, this has been restricted. And it should not be used in patients who have had previous pancreatic or biliary tract disease. Probably should not be used in patients with advanced liver disease. It's one where you want to be very cautious before using it. And I would probably use it only when all other medications had failed and with the full knowledge by the patient that severe side effects can occur.
What are the challenges that still exist in the management of IBSD? How can a gastroenterologist approach this?
There are numerous challenges. First is that irritable bowel syndrome is probably not a disease, but a constellation of disorders, which probably occur through many different mechanisms. As a result, there isn't a precise a drug target that one can use to account for all patients. And because of this, there's probably no medication, at least in placebo-controlled trials, that has ever worked for more than 50 to 60% of patients in the trial, and then not always entirely. So almost any approach that you use in the patient with irritable bowel syndrome is going to have both successes as well as continuing challenges. And that's going to continue until we have some better understanding of what the underlying pathophysiology is in a given patient. The second thing is that irritable bowel syndrome, like other functional bowel disorders, is considered a biopsychosocial disorder. That is, there is a combination of both biologic, in this case, gut function or gut motility and sensation, that mixed in with a central nervous system and peripheral nervous system issues, and that includes both behavior as well as neurophysiology. So that one is really treating and has to pay attention to both in order to be successful. Now, this is why in most trials, the placebo response rate can be quite substantial in patients with irritable bowel syndrome, indicating that some of the success that we see may not be due to specific drug interventions. Therefore, the major challenges for any gastroenterologist is to understand not only the symptoms, but also the patient and their background. And this means establishing a very strong patient healthcare provider relationship. It's probably the most important component in the treatment of patients with irritable bowel syndrome. This is becoming critically prohibitive because more and more gastroenterologists have less time to spend with their patients because they're busy doing other things, including procedures or working with Epic and other kinds of automated systems that they have to deal with. And so it may be that we have to establish a team approach to a patient with irritable bowel, which will consist of both advanced providers as well as psychologists, nutritionists, and others. The failure to pay attention to the relationship, to establish a strong one, is probably going to increase the risk that you're going to have an ineffective outcome. The second thing that is a challenge for the a physician is the importance of dietary contributions to GI symptoms. Whether it's focusing on the microbiome or the role that foods play in generating symptoms. And this, again, is a time-consuming function that has to be done. And so perhaps more and more we're going to require a team approach in order to get the those factors into play, and also in using dietary interventions. But the most important issue, I think, in irritable bowel is the concept of the behavioral effects both on GI function, but also the behavioral effects on the response of the patient to those symptoms. And in the end, we probably are not going to make their GI symptoms perfect, but we're going to have to allow them to come to grips with their symptoms and to live more reasonably well or tolerate their symptoms in a more positive fashion.
How often do you recommend a patient modify their diet to control their IBS? And should gastroenterologists regularly refer patients to dietitians or nutritionists to help relieve symptom burden?
I've long been aware and personally advocated the importance of foods and diet on GI symptoms. This can occur in a number of ways, but there's been, of course, great emphasis on the ingestion of fermentable foods, which can also often cause gas, bloating, alterations in bowel habits. We understand that diet has a profound effect on the gut microbiome, particularly in the colon, and probably what we eat has a profound effect on those bacteria and which ones are dominating what's going on at the GI level. We also know what goes on in the microbiome can have an effect on the intestine itself in terms of its nerve and muscle function. So diet is probably one of the most important things that I get to when I'm seeing a patient. If I have the time, and I try to get an understanding of what kinds of foods they're eating, and particularly those that might cause specific symptoms. Particularly with gas and bloating, I really do concentrate on the fermentable foods that they're ingesting. But I also spend a fair amount of time finding out what they are drinking as well. Since many patients are taking sugar-free candies or chewing sugar-free gums, or they're adding sugar-free sweeteners to their liquids, or they're consuming things like soda, which may have a high amount of fructose and other poorly absorbable carbohydrates. And very often, not only the kind, but the amount of food that they eat will have a profound role. initially one can do it in a limited way, but I do think that the use of a nutritionist is a very important aspect of patients with irritable bowel and functional bowel symptoms. The way I interact with nutritionists is that I try to indicate to them what specific diet and outcome I'm looking for. It's not enough to simply send the patient to a nutritionist who can then discuss this and that with the patient. You have to be very specific about what you would like to have. And if I really want them to do a low FODMAP diet, that's what I'll ask them to do rather than giving them a sort of a free standing approach to the patient. Just as I would send them for a gluten-free diet if I had a patient who I thought was a celiac disease or a gluten intolerant person. The other side of the coin is that the dietitians or nutritionists that you use really should be well-trained and knowledgeable about things like the low FODMAP diet and others. And I think that not all nutritionists are particularly adept at doing that. So working closely with a nutritionist can be very valuable, although I often do it myself by giving out information about what constitutes a low FODMAP diet and offering a patient to perhaps do it on their own. This can save a visit, and often it can lead to good outcomes. There's been a lot of discussion about gluten intolerant people who don't have celiac disease, and I think that's a really controversial area. There are some studies that suggest that patients who perceive themselves to be gluten intolerant are really intolerant to the fructans in the diet, and it's not the glucose. On the other hand, gluten can be a poorly absorbable and fermentable substance that can contribute real symptoms to patients with functional bowel disorders. And of course, patients will come with their own ideas about nutrition and foods. Unfortunately, they may have been seen by other practitioners who use allergy testing and things of that nature to identify foods that they may be causing symptoms. But we have to emphasize to the patient that these tests that are used to poorly indicate what the response will be to eliminating these foods in their diet. And a lot of the tests that they use have not been validated. So I think that food allergies are something that I discourage. And I really emphasize more of the food intolerance that I think is very common in patients with IBS.
In your opinion, is cognitive behavioral therapy an effective method to recommend to patients to relieve symptoms of IBS?
I really am a strong believer in cognitive behavioral therapy. I have been since the earlier studies emphasizing cognitive behavioral therapy were published in the 2000s, first by Doug Grossman at North Carolina, and most recently by Jeff Blackner, who's at the State University of New York in Buffalo. Jeff has particularly demonstrated the importance of cognitive behavioral therapy as a very robust treatment for patients who are not responding to, shall we say, usual treatment modules. And he's recently published and has done a big NIH study which showed that short-term cognitive behavioral therapy may be just as effective as a long-term cognitive behavioral therapy. The issue here is that cognitive behavioral therapy requires special training, but it's also a very time-intensive issue. And Jeff has shown that by using take-home tapes and other modalities, that he can reduce the amount of time spent with the psychologist or the practitioner of cognitive behavioral therapy to get a good output. So I think CBT, as it's known, is very robust. I would say that probably a third of my patients will benefit from that. But in reality, I don't send patients unless I really think there's a problem in terms of how they respond to stressors. And I think that any program that deals with irritable bowel syndrome and other functional bowel disorders should really be working closely with a practitioner of CBT. And again, not all psychologists or psychiatric social workers are skilled in this. And so it does take some extra training and interest to do it.
What are three key takeaways gastroenterologists should keep in mind when managing a patient with IBS or IBSD?
Well, these are old-fashioned, but I think it's time tested and true. And I think it's there's data to support it. I think that the first issue is that the patient-practitioner relationship is probably the most important component of a successful treatment for IBS. Now, this is really critically established during the first several visits, and shortchanging that process can lead to less successful outputs. There's extra time that's spent in doing so, but I think you get a lot of positive downstream effects. It's become particularly problematic as gastroenterologists become more and more constricted in the time they're seeing patients. And that's why I think perhaps a team approach is important, but bonding with the team and in a very active, positive relationship, I think is probably the most important thing. The second thing is I really do think that assessment of dietary contributions to GI symptoms really play an important role in many patients, both diarrhea or constipation or the like. And while we have many treatments that we can use, these are fundamental concepts that can work effectively in many patients, even to the point sometimes where I'll have a patient keep a one-week diary of the foods that they eat, in order for me to understand just what's going in and what may be a contribution. The third message, I think, and I think it's well known among gastroenterologists, is that no treatment intervention by itself is effective in more than 40 to 50% of patients. And while treatment is important in terms of medications and the like, one has to take a very holistic view of these patients. And this gets us back to the biopsychosocial model of understanding who the patient is, what are the consequences of the symptoms, and how does the patient react to those symptoms in terms of a positive or a negative way. So at the end of the day, it may be less important to control diarrhea or constipation, and more important to focus on their quality of life and their ability to adjust to and understand these symptoms. And this is where an evaluation of both the person as well as the symptoms is critical.
Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Wald.